From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. As the world continues to battle the coronavirus, it's also fighting a different sort of epidemic, misinformation. Now, the infodemic is just as harmful as COVID-19 itself, leading people to downplay the severity of the disease and ignore public health advice in favor of unproved treatments or cures. Joining us from Scientific America magazine is science journalist and health medicine editor Tanya Lewis. She's written a recent article in the magazine titled, 9 COVID-19 Myths That Just Won't Go Away. From the plandemic video to the myth that COVID-19 is no more deadly than the flu, Tanya Lewis joins us to help us decipher information from disinformation. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio, Tanya.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you back. And maybe we should just start at the top with myth number one, the coronavirus was engineered in a lab in China.
Yeah, so basically this is the idea that President Trump and other people have basically claimed that, you know, just because the virus first started circulating in Wuhan, China, that it must have come from a human lab there and was deliberately engineered to be deadly and a bioweapon. But this, you know, as I say in the story, is really, there's just really no evidence for this. Many, many viruses exist in the wild in animals like bats, and coronaviruses in particular have been isolated from numerous strains of these viruses have been isolated from bats in the wild. So there's really no reason to suggest that it came from a lab, and there's no evidence to support that claim.
And I believe China has even invited researchers from the World Health Organization to come in and take a look at everything to try to pull this sort of theory apart.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, there are, legitimate reasons to always be concerned about the potential of, for example, an accidental lab release of a virus, because many labs do study these dangerous pathogens. But in this case, the virologist that was studying, that does study many of these coronaviruses, actually looked at all of the sequences of viruses that she studies and did not find any of them were a perfect match for COVID-19. Or for the virus that causes COVID-19. So it really, although it's impossible to completely rule out that, maybe there was something funny going on, there's really just no evidence for that. And even our intelligence agencies have said that there's no evidence that this was an engineered virus.
Yeah, and just to add one final thing, and that's several weeks ago, Lynn and I spoke with David Quammen, who wrote the book Spillover back in 2012. The opening paragraph says something big is happening. It's not coming from outer space. It's probably coming from a lab in China. Yeah, not a lab, but a wet market in China. It's probably coming from a bat. And he goes on to describe in tremendous detail what the coronavirus is. And this is, of course, 8 years ago. So I have no idea how these things happen.
Right. I mean, they're just sort of circulating out there in the animals in the wild, and it's pretty rare for them to jump into humans, but it's sort of only a matter of time as long as humans are interacting closely with wildlife.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Tanya Lewis from Scientific American. She has written an article in Scientific American titled 9 COVID-19 Myths That Just Won't Go Away. And Tanya, part of the reason the myths won't go away is that they get widespread exposure. Like this video, Plandemic, that was based on a book by this woman named Judy Mikovits. It has garnered more than 8 million views on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's since been taken down, but of course, conspiracy theorists say that that's a conspiracy, that the powers that be want to keep the real information from the people. So talk a little bit about Plandemic and about how widely really discredited Julie Mikovits has been in the past, before even before COVID-19 came around, and then how this continues to get so much attention.
Right. So, I mean, this film, Plandemic, was circulated online, and, basically it just sort of opened this Pandora's box of conspiracy theories, some of them related to coronavirus and some of them related to HIV and, Dr. Fauci, and just this, woman and former scientist, Judy Mikovits, basically, had worked, doing research on chronic fatigue syndrome in, I think the 90s. And she basically made some high profile claims in an article that was later retracted and basically debunked. So she didn't exactly have, the most stellar reputation to begin with. And then she was making all these claims about how Anthony Fauci was suppressing information about HIV and that Bill Gates is trying to develop a coronavirus vaccine that will, kill lots of people, which is absolutely untrue. And there was no basis for any of these claims. But the documentary was made to sort of have this aura of authority. And I think people, some people, conspiracy theorists, kind of believe that there's always, powerful forces trying to suppress the truth. And in this case, there just wasn't any evidence to support that. But it was just too irresistible, and many people watched this video.
Yeah, so when you talk about all of these claims that have no evidence backing them, those kinds of claims are thrown out regularly by many people, including our president. And they get so much traction, and those people, in fact, I have someone very near and dear to me that I share blood with who, believes in these conspiracy theorists, has a QAnon bumper sticker on her car, and will tell you that she would say something like, well, Scientific American is just blustering and, can't back it up with evidence. And, who can you trust? And I think this is sort of the thing that comes back to a lot of people who typically follow credible news sources. They start to go, well, who can we trust?
Yeah, and I think, that's just sort of a symptom of this larger issue of distrust in science and authority. And I think, unfortunately, the media has sort of been caught up in this as well, where people are no longer believing trusted news sources. But in reality, at our publication, we do rely on, going back to the original source and the original science to try to unpack, all of these claims. And we know, for example, that vaccines have a long history of not only being safe, but preventing millions of deaths from deadly diseases like polio, for example. And, these diseases we don't see them every day because of vaccines. But unfortunately, a minority of people have managed to spread false claims about vaccines. And that's, potentially very dangerous, because if and when we finally get a coronavirus vaccine, we do want people to take it, because we want to make sure that we can get this virus under control and stop just this, unending amount of suffering and death.
Well, it sure is interesting, because the 9 myths for the people that read your magazine, the people that are, maybe open-minded, would be agreeing with everything that you say, but anybody else, like the anti-vaxxers, or the people that think that Gates and Fauci use their power to profit from the disease, or those people will read, if they were to read your magazine, they would just dismiss it just immediately. And it's that whole distrust in science, authority, the polarized shape that we find ourselves in this country. And that's the real key question. I just don't know how you get around that, because they've proven that if you present facts and you try to do it systematically and without raising your voice and taking someone through the facts, that they just basically dig their heels in and say, nope, I'm entitled to my opinions. So how do we get around that? I mean, that's a question that's, of course, very difficult to answer, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually, and it's something that I certainly thought about when I was writing this piece. And I think, you know, it's a tough thing because, you know, on the one hand, you're right, you know, if somebody is completely set in their beliefs, no amount of facts or evidence is really going to persuade them. But at the same time, I do think, you know, as a scientific authority and, source of trusted information, I think it is our duty to kind of put forward the facts as they exist and try to lay all the information out there so that people who may be undecided or somewhat in the middle might be reached by just this sort of cool evidence-based thinking. And, you know, who knows, maybe I don't reach anybody, but we actually have a special issue or a special section of the magazine coming up dealing with misinformation, and we go through some of the reasons why people believe these conspiracy theories. And, you know, sometimes they're based on some sort of kernel of truth, but it just becomes very quickly manipulated by, the people that want you to believe something nefarious is going on. And so we kind of go through the psychology behind that, and hopefully we can kind of help understand it, if not, you know, completely change the situation.
Yeah, well, that'll be fascinating. We look forward to that. Maybe we can take a look at myth number three, which is that COVID-19 is no worse than the flu.
Yeah, this was, interesting because when I wrote the story, as of a few weeks ago, you know, President Trump had been claiming really from the get-go that this virus is not really any worse than the flu. And even though, as we've seen, the number of deaths far exceeds flu deaths in a typical year, which are anywhere from 12,000 to 60,000 deaths a year. And of course, we're now reaching close to 200,000 deaths from coronavirus. So, you know, that was sort of bad enough. But then as we learned a couple of, I think last week, journalist Bob Woodward of the Washington Post published recordings of Trump actually telling him back in February and March that he knew it was worse than the flu and he knew it was more severe and it was airborne, but he just wanted to downplay the severity because he didn't want people to panic. But meanwhile, he was publicly just saying, you know, it was nothing more than a flu. And I think that just shows, you know, how nefarious some of these beliefs are. And it's not just misinformation. Sometimes it's actually disinformation because you're spreading things that are, you're knowingly spreading false information.
So, Tanya, we're coming up on about 200,000 deaths in the U.S., yet one of the stories that is circulating out there is that the numbers are incorrect because the CDC will count a death from COVID when there's been a comorbidity, when someone is diabetic or obese or, you know, has some underlying issue prior to COVID, and they're counting these deaths as COVID deaths when it is felt that the numbers should more reflect them dying from whatever the underlying disease was. Can you talk a little bit about that and how the numbers are either manipulated or true or what have you?
Sure. So this idea is very popular, and you can imagine why. I mean, if it turned out that all of these deaths were actually just people who were dying of other illnesses, you know, of course that would be welcome news. The problem with that idea is that there's a very easy way to kind of look at whether or not we're seeing deaths, more deaths this year from COVID, and that's just to compare it with sort of the background rate of deaths in a typical year. And you can very quickly see that we have far higher, you know, numbers of people dying now. So if these people, you know, who have diabetes or cancer or any other serious health condition were just dying of those diseases, then they would, you know, we would expect it to be a similar death rate to other years. But in fact, we're seeing far more deaths. And in many cases, not all of these people are even getting counted as coronavirus deaths. So if anything, it probably, experts think it's probably an undercount of the number of deaths from this virus.
Yeah. Well, moving on to the myth about masks, that you don't need to wear a mask. And of course, this was something that, you know, the CDC and the World Health Organization in the beginning felt wasn't going to help. And then they pivoted as they got, as the science proved out to show that actually masks will help. And in fact, I just read something a couple of days ago. I'm forgetting. It was in one of the major newspapers that talked about some research going on that masks may actually increase your immunity to COVID-19. And I'm sure that has something to do with the viral load just being so little, and you're just getting little tiny amounts of it, which would in turn build your immunity just like a vaccine would.
Yeah. So, well, let me just answer the first part of your question, which is, you know, as you pointed out, you know, the early guidance on masks was confusing because partly because the CDC and the WHO, you know, although they did know that masks can be effective at preventing transmission of respiratory illnesses like the flu, there really was a major shortage of masks in the beginning, and continuing till today, we don't have enough of the sort of high quality masks like N95 masks and surgical masks. But the problem was that they sort of conflated that mask shortage with this message that actually masks don't help, which I think was a misstep. And what we know now is that many, many cases of coronavirus are actually asymptomatic. So, you know, wearing a mask isn't going to protect you if you don't even know that you're sick. So, well, it will protect you if you're wearing it, but if you don't know that you're sick and you're not wearing a mask, you could be transmitting the virus. So I think now there's just such a wealth of evidence that wearing masks can prevent you from spreading the virus to others. And there is some evidence that it can protect you from other people, although that is somewhat more up for debate. But we definitely know that masks overall, you know, prevent transmission. Just to address the other point you made about whether masks provide any type of immunity, I think that's a little bit more speculative idea at this point. But I think, as I understand it, the idea is that if you're wearing a mask, you might still be exposed to very small numbers of viral particles, and that could sort of prime your immune system to mount a small response and give you some immunity, but there's just not very much evidence of that right now, so I would hesitate to say that that's really happening, but it is an intriguing idea.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. We are speaking with science journalist and health and medicine editor Tanya Lewis from Scientific American. She has recently published an article, 9 COVID-19 Myths That Just Won't Go Away. And we're just talking about wearing a mask. You know, Tanya, I was speaking with my doctor this morning who contracted COVID-19 and gave it to her husband and gave it to her daughter, I believe it was. And she believes that she got it from, you know, she was doing all these video type visits as a doctor, but there were some people that had to come in, and she would walk into the waiting room, and it would be, and the patient would have been sitting there for 10 or 15 minutes waiting for her to arrive, and their mask wasn't on. And she could say to the person, can you please put your mask on? But that person's been sitting in that waiting room for 15 minutes, and those droplets, if the person was infected, are circulating throughout the air. You know, there's no fan or anything in there. So this mask thing is is just fascinating because it really can get the curve down, knock that curve out. And it's unfortunate, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, the more we learn about this virus, the more we are understanding that it absolutely can be transmitted through the air, and that the virus, that the droplets, you know, might just hang in the air for some period of time. So it's not enough to just sort of have your mask on when you're around other people, but we do need to sort of keep it on anytime we're indoors in an enclosed space, and even outdoors if you're within 6 feet of people or in a crowd. It's definitely important because, as you said, you know, it's really the only weapon the main weapon we have against this virus at this point.
Yeah. Well, we definitely want to talk about hydroxychloroquine is an effective treatment, that myth. Before we do, though, there is something in that that I had not heard before, and I just get a kick out of it, and that's that our president retweeted a video viewed tens of millions of times before it was taken down, featuring Stella Emanuel, a Houston, Texas-based physician, who basically was saying that hydroxychloroquine is an effective treatment for COVID-19. But you say in the article, I get such a kick out of this because I'm going to start spreading this rumor. This is just the best. This woman, Stella, has made questionable assertions in the past, including that doctors used alien DNA in treatments, that demons cause certain medical conditions by having sex with people in their dreams. What a great story that is. Lynn, we have to do a story on demons having sex with people in their dreams and giving them different medical conditions. That's a very bizarre thing.
Pretty incredible that, you know, the.
But I'm spreading that one.
President himself. Tanya, I'm spreading this.
I am. I'm quoting you. I'm saying, you know, Tanya told me that this stuff's really going on.
Yeah, I mean, it really boggles the mind sometimes that the types of experts that we are, or quote unquote experts that are being trotted out in support of some of these claims. I mean, you know, don't take my word for it, but I don't think I would take a drug that was, you know, being promoted by a doctor who believes in alien DNA and demons, you know, causing crazy medical conditions. So I think it just goes to show that we've gone so far beyond medical and scientific expertise, and we're just sort of seeing, you know, the Trump administration bringing out all kinds of bizarre experts out there to support their claims. And I think it just shows how desperate people are for any kind of good news about this virus. But I would be the first to, you know, rally in support of a drug if it was proven to be effective. But hydroxychloroquine just over and over has been shown to have no benefit for coronavirus patients. And in fact, in some cases, may actually be harmful. So I really think we need to be guided by evidence here, and, you know, randomized clinical trials of drugs, just to really know if there's anything that's effective out there. You really have to test it on a population of people in a very scientific way. And we just haven't had that. We haven't seen any good evidence for hydroxychloroquine.
And, you know, Tanya, there are doctors and then there are doctors. Like someone who would be quoting this Stella Emanuel, who is a doctor, would say that, well, Stella Emanuel is a doctor, so I believe it. And I think Judy Mikovits is either a PhD or a physician. I'm not sure, a medical doctor. And, you know, just because someone's a doctor doesn't mean, you know, you look just one step further to see how they're, you know, their claims have been discredited widely, including, you know, the one about alien DNA. You know, it's kind of crazy. Just because you went through medical school doesn't necessarily mean that everyone should believe anything you say, including, you know,
right,
our president.
That's true. And it just shows that even, you know, doctors and scientists are susceptible to misinformation and spreading false claims. And I think, you know, yeah, like you said, just because somebody has a PhD, it doesn't mean that they are qualified to as an expert on coronaviruses or on, you know, infectious disease in general. So I think we really just need to look at what the scientific consensus is, and that's why you have to sort of look at what are the studies coming out of, you know, reputable journals, and what are the clinical trials, randomized clinical trials finding, because that's really the only way to really tell if something is effective. You can't just test it on a couple of people and say, oh yeah, this works. You know, you have to actually give some people the drug and compare it to people who didn't get the drug, and make sure you have a big enough sample of people. And that's the way science works. And unfortunately, it's frustratingly slow sometimes, but it does get results.
Yeah. And, you know, just to mention about when our president speaks in superlatives, as he does, you know, whether you like him or not, he always talks about this is the biggest and the best and the greatest in the history of mankind, sort of thing. And I think, you know, in part, it's because he's trying to instill confidence in, you know, his constituents, which is understandable. But when, you know, in the case of hydroxychloroquine, talking about this is one of the biggest game changers in the history of medicine is a quote by him. It's hard to walk that back. It's hard to turn around and say, well, actually, it's not. And that's what I think part of it is what can, you know, makes these myths endure.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when the person who occupies the highest office in the country says something like that, you know, people are going to pay attention. But as you say, you know, it's really, it's a lot of kind of over the top, you know, exaggeration, and it's just, it's hard to, you know, there are drugs out there that are somewhat effective, but the effect sizes are really small, and, you know, you have to kind of put everything in context. We don't have a drug that can save everyone's life. We have drugs that, like steroid drugs, that can reduce the number of deaths in very severe cases, but we just don't have anything close to a cure. So I think you have to be careful in how you communicate about these things, and have to, you know, especially when you have an audience as big as the president does, I think it's important to kind of, you know, really just stick to what the science shows and not overhype these treatments, because they're, people need to understand that this is a deadly disease and that we don't have some magic silver bullet cure for it.
We only have a couple of minutes left, Tanya. We should probably talk about herd immunity, though, before we go. If that is, I mean, that's one of your myths that you put down there. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this idea just keeps cropping up again. I mean, this concept of herd immunity is something that epidemiologists talk about, and it can happen, basically, it just means that enough of the population has either had a virus or a disease or is vaccinated against it that it can no longer spread in the population. And a lot of countries, you know, like including the UK and Sweden, early on in the pandemic kind of looked like they were pursuing this policy of just letting the virus infect people, until they reached herd immunity. But the problem with that is that you would have to infect so many people that, you know, given the mortality rate of the virus, of the disease, a lot of people would have to die in order to reach that point without a vaccine. Now, obviously, we all hope that there will be a vaccine at some point, but even President Trump has sort of repeated this claim just as recently as this past week. I think he called it herd mentality, but he, I believe, meant herd immunity. And the problem with that is that given the mortality rate of the disease, you'd have to infect, you know, close to 3 million people in order, or sorry, you'd have to have 3 million people die in order to reach that threshold. And I don't think anyone in their right mind would think that that's an acceptable, I mean, obviously no number of deaths is acceptable, but that's just beyond the pale. So I think we really can't rely on that as a strategy to curb the virus, this transmission.
Well, I had a conversation with someone recently, and I basically said, well, we have almost 200,000 people that are dead. And herd immunity, if it was 70% of 330 million people, that would mean 231 million people would have to test positive. And if 2% of those were to pass away, that'd be 4.6 million. And the person looked at me and said, yeah, so what? You know, what's your point? So there are people out there that, I'm not trying to be funny, honestly. There are people out there that believe that there are acceptable numbers to this type of thing. So that's, of course, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but it's there are people that feel that way. But Tanya, we want to thank you so much for being with us on the program again. Tanya Lewis, journalist and health and medicine editor for Scientific American. Thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.